Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Off Track Podcast. I'm your host, as always, Matt Eshy, and it is great to have you here. Thank you for pulling a chair up to the table. We could not be more excited to have you here. This week, we changed the flavor up just a little bit. No questions. We threw a little extra sugar and spice in there. Actually, pulled out the sugar and spice, quite honestly. As many of you know, this is a big panel of group of coaches that get together and talk about track and field each and every week. And due to, you know, the nature of our jobs and things that are going on sometimes, every time we can't get everybody, you know, together at the table. So where is everybody, you asked this week? Well, John is out of the A-10 championships. Congrats to the Billikens. Great job out there. Big shout out with those guys. Scott is getting wall-to-wall carpet put into his penthouse in Reno. Tom is babysitting kids, and apparently they're not his kids, so who knows who he's babysitting. And Herb is sitting at Pottery Barn debating the shades of color he needs for his lampshades, for his drapes, and for everything else going on. So Darren and I have the absolute pleasure of sitting down with Tom Schwartz, the head coach of 10-Man Elite, the professional running group. And we talk about a lot of different things, honestly. The mad scientist himself opens up about his PhD, a little bit of work that he's working on, his time at UW La Crosse, how he got into coaching, the realization that all elite groups are not created equal, the struggles he has with 10-Man Elite, nothing bad, just normal coaching struggles, how they fund themselves. And along with, we talk about some of the great races in track and field history, especially on the distance side, but just how, you know, shying away from a race is nothing that helps the sport at all. But we also come up with a pro running system that might actually work and help be advantageous to athletes. So sit back and relax on this one. We are excited to have you here. Once again, Tom Schwartz with 10-Man Elite.
It was what set me up, I believe, for the kind of problem that I had. And so I became determined once I started realizing that I wasn't going to become the kind of runner that I wanted to be, that I knew I could be, to maybe devote my attention to learning how to be a good coach, learning about better training methods, how to individualize training. Mm-hmm. I think the thing that I learned most was that the vast majority of athletes on a team don't have the kind of individualized training they need. Paces are too fast, the amount is too much, or too little, the type of training is wrong for their profile. You know, what I found extraordinary is that in college, a lot of the athletes who were skipping workouts because they had lab, like biology lab or physics lab, were doing better.
Mm-hmm. they
missed the Tuesday brutal track session, you know, and back then, you know, we had hard workout on Tuesday, hard workout on Thursday, competition on Saturday, fast long run on Sunday, or Monday workout hard, Wednesday workout hard, Friday or Saturday race, or Friday or Saturday hard workout, and then fast long run on Sunday. That was norm. Some people even ran one or two more interval sessions than that at various universities. That was the norm.
I've always heard horror stories of that kind of stuff. Some friends down at Loyola did those stuff where they'd be doing a hard Monday, hard Tuesday, relatively easier, but still hard Wednesday. And then all of a sudden, Thursday, Friday, trying to recover for a Friday or Saturday race, but they never stopped. And again, Sunday was that same long, intense workout because they just couldn't back off no matter what they did.
Yeah, exactly. And it takes its toll. But, you know, with what I found interesting was not only the individuals who missed key workouts because of their labs, but got injured and they missed a portion of the training in the middle of the season. Mm-hmm. They came back on fire at the end of the season and crushed it and beat people.
Just rested.
Had fresh legs.
Not only that, but a lot of times, like if they had an injury, they might've been out for a week or two, but the athletic trainers who were quite prudent at our university, very brilliant, would say, hey, look, I think you need to skip 50% of the workouts for the next 3 weeks or something like that.
Yeah.
And what would happen is these guys would end up getting a period of 4, 5, 6 weeks in a row where they were just doing distance running, small amounts of quality, well below the amount that they would normally. Mm-hmm. And it was just enough to keep them fit. just enough to maybe use their talent.
Yep.
And not burn it out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so.
So how do you go from, so you're a student at lacrosse, things aren't going well, all that kind of stuff. You have the compartment syndrome. My sister actually had compartment syndrome, and they actually had a different thing, you know, and this was not too long ago, 2007, 2008, they had a study where a doctor from the University of Texas actually shot anesthesia down her lower back from L3, L4, and that helped out. So she didn't have to do surgery, which was amazing. And it worked incredibly.
Really?
Yeah, it was something I've never seen before. And it was one of the, you know, experimental treatment. They wrote it up in this Journal of Medicine, and it worked well. But wow. So you're at lacrosse as a student, and then how do you start working with coaches to coach, or how do you get into actual coaching?
Well, much credit goes to Dr. Phil Leston. He was our cross country coach, and then he coached distance the first year that I was there, but then he kind of backed off because his sons were in high school and that sort of thing. So he didn't coach any of us during track after my first year. But he's an exercise physiologist. He taught at the university, and he saw ability in me. He and Dr. Floyd were the ones who right away said, look, you got some ability in understanding science and being able to interpret it and apply it that we haven't seen before, or we've hardly ever seen.
Yep.
And you certainly have a passion for this. Let's keep that fire burning. And Dr. Aston would basically say, hey, what do you think we should do? And I'm like, well, here's what I would do. This is what the science says. We need to do more lactate threshold type training. We need to raise our lactate threshold because all these guys have fairly high VO2 max and they're not going to get any higher.
Mm-hmm.
Right? We know that after a couple of years of really intense training, you won't raise your VO2 max anymore.
No.
So what you need to do is improve the speed at which you achieve your VO2 max, and you need to be able to increase the duration that you can sustain it, but you also need to increase your what is called cruising speed. That's a term I borrow from famous coach Harry Wilson, who's long ago passed on, but he was Steve Ovett's coach, Julian Goder, Wendy Sly, a bunch of others in England.
Some great names, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So we need to improve the cruising speed. He's like, okay, well, you love this stuff and you're good with it. You come up with some workouts and you come up with some way of quantifying this for everybody on the team, because you're constantly saying, look, we need to individualize the paces. We can't have everybody just running hard and trying to keep up with the leaders. And I said, okay. So then I made all kinds of training pace charts, and we used them all the time when I was an undergrad. Many of the workouts that I was designing were getting implemented, except, unfortunately, not all of what I was recommending was used for the entire season. What I was recommending was being used at the beginning of this season, all the way to the middle of the season. And at the end of this season, Dr. Aston went back to what he had always prescribed because he felt most comfortable with that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there was an awful lot of pressure from some of the older guys on the team that they had to run fast in training, and the goal pace training and all that. But I was saying the science doesn't really prove that one bit.
Yeah.
That doesn't help. And I said, what I see out there in reality is guys being able to go out fast, for example, in a cross country race, but they fade.
Mm-hmm.
They fade big time because now we're doing these high intensity interval workouts. The volume is dropping. They got all kinds of anaerobic capacity now, but you don't need that much anaerobic capacity when you're running 8K cross country.
No.
Really, it's only about 3 or 4%.
Mm-hmm.
That's about it overall. And the problem is if you raise your anaerobic capacity without being able to also raise your aerobic capacity, and when I say capacity, I don't mean power. I mean actual the fractional utilization of it, which is represented by such things as threshold velocity or critical velocity, as a submax. If those erode, you're in trouble. I don't care how good your power is, you're just going to fade. Mm-hmm. So you don't really need that much anaerobic capacity training. For 800 meters and below, sure you do. Mm-hmm. For even the 1500, the vast majority of guys, I wouldn't say the vast majority, I would say the majority, maybe 60%, don't need much anaerobic capacity training. They need just enough to get the job done. Because the problem is every time they focus on anaerobic capacity training, they erode their fractional utilization and they just build up too much leg fatigue too early. And I don't care how strong mentally they are, they're just going to fade. You know, the big misnomer that we deal with in our sport is that people are not mentally tough. You know, that's okay to say for the novice who's in the sport, who doesn't understand how to deal with fatigue, mm-hmm. doesn't know how to interpret fatigue. But the veteran who's been in the sport a while fully understands that fatigue is part of the game and learns to deal and manage with fatigue. It's one of the extraordinary abilities of the endurance athlete, is the ability to tolerate, accept, and keep pressing on in the face of fatigue, you know, in the face of adversity. The endurance athlete is extraordinary. So I do not think it's mental toughness that hinders the majority of runners. It's their aerobic, anaerobic, unbalanced profile.
No, I can actually see that, especially going back into some of the college days and the workouts that we did. I can definitely tell that sometimes we need to be a little more individualistic, and there's workouts I rocked and workouts my teammates rocked, and, you know, things that I just hung on for, and always somebody had one extra little gear. But so you went to, so at UWL, where do you go after this?
Well, I stayed there and got my master's degree. Actually,
that's okay.
Thanks, honey. My wife is giving me food.
Oh, there you go. Yeah.
Actually, I turned down a full ride to Michigan State. I could have got my master's and PhD 30 years ago. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, I had a girlfriend that I was head over heels for and didn't want to leave. And she was in the hospital and stuff like that.
So that stuff will happen.
I had to stick around. Mm-hmm. So I stuck around lacrosse.
Yep.
Went to grad school. So I was a volunteer coach, writing a lot of the workouts. You know, Dr. Eston, of course, was in charge.
Yep.
And then I was a grad assistant, mm-hmm. human performance laboratory grad assistant. I tested people in the lab all the time. Mm-hmm. I taught classes as well.
Okay.
That was a good experience. Mm-hmm. And then I moved to the Chicago area, worked as a YMCA fitness director. And then I was a coach at Concordia University River Forest, which is now called Concordia University Chicago, which happens to be the place where I'm getting my PhD right now.
Jeez, a little bit of a full circle there.
I had no idea that I would be, you know, working on a doctorate there, because they certainly didn't have that program when I was there. Mm-hmm. And they created the program something like 7 years ago, mm-hmm. An online program for people who are working professionals. If you'd be surprised how many people in my doctoral program. So I started with a cohort of probably 12. Mm-hmm. Probably seven of them survived.
Jeez.
Maybe six, something like that. And I'm the only one that's not a college professor or associate professor.
I would figure that as much.
All the ones that were in there were, you know, there were a couple that I don't think made it, that were like head sports trainers, athletic trainers, or strength trainers for major D1 university programs. Mm-hmm. One was one in my program. I think he graduated. He was a strength training coach for the Denver Nuggets basketball team. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the people, one was a professional soccer coach. He used to be a professional soccer player. So all of them are pretty interesting people. Very neat to have as cohorts. But yeah.
Now get a bite there real quick. I know you're kind of looking at the dinner being like, and I know you came just off of training and everything that you were doing. Yeah, you got to get some food here. No questions about it. We've had a few things happen on the podcast, and eating dinner and having a drink is definitely not one of the things that, you know, but we're not 4-2. So that's not an issue at all. But I mean, that's an incredible group right there that you're talking about getting a PhD with, and especially on that online thing. So you hit back to Concordia, you do that. So how do you get yourself essentially out to Colorado and start going from where you are? Because that's kind of the interesting thing. Like, there was no big, well, I mean, at that point, there wasn't anything big, and you'd already turned down a PhD program.
Yeah. Well, I mean, a lot has happened between then and now. But, you know, the truth is we gave up on a lot to move to Colorado. My wife reminds me all the time that she gave up a much higher salary, teaching salary. Mm-hmm. Our house now here in Colorado is more than twice as expensive as it was in Idaho, where we were living in the Boise area. We gave up an awful lot to move here to be part, you know, have me coach the 10-man elite guys.
Mm-hmm. One thing we talked about was that it's just been tough in general. So you come over from Idaho to do that kind of thing. Was there just a desire to do it? How does 10 man get started?
I got told it was either I come over or they're going to replace me.
Oh, geez. Mm-hmm. Okay. So you definitely had no choice. Like, man, I got to go then. No questions about that one.
Yeah. And I debated because, you know, it felt like coercion and it still does. But, you know, there were some individuals on the team like Drew that I promised I would help coach. I promised I'd be there for him if, you know.
Well, sitting back doing a great job with that, and he's a great test subject with it. What did you've been over here? What's one of the biggest challenges that you've had at Tim Manley? I know one thing you and I had talked about off camera before, when we were just kind of I guess just getting to know each other a little bit. One of the hardest things you said was sponsorship, of course, and making sure you guys have the gear and things. But as shown for, if you take a look at social, you know, there's some incredible gear that you guys have out there, the 10 man tour, as you guys call it, I believe it is. But how does, so what has been some of the biggest issues you guys have run into with the group?
Well, there's issues for the team. There's issue for the coaches. They're different. Mm-hmm. The issues for the coaches is the team, the runners on the team are our boss. Mm-hmm. I'm not an Adidas coach. Much to the, you know, surprise of most people, I'm not. Mm-hmm. I'm not paid by Adidas.
Yeah.
So those guys are my boss. That makes it hard for me to get them to do what I think they need to do. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying?
Yep.
And they feel like they can do whatever they want to do whenever they want to do it. They want to add a race. They want to do whatever they can. Mm-hmm. So that's the really hard part that the coaching staff deals with. Mm-hmm. Changing of race schedules, it seems to be an ongoing problem. Mm-hmm. I mean, the coaching staff goes crazy, and me in particular, the one who designs the training.
I would assume so.
We're going to add this race. We're going to subtract that race. We're going to go, what? Mm-hmm. It'd be a piece of cake to coach at a university where there's a set rate, you know, competition schedule. You'd know it well in advance. Mm-hmm. And you plan for everything. It's a piece of cake. Mm-hmm. This is constantly juggling.
So if you got that, where does, not an Adidas coach, not sponsored by him, that kind of thing. It's not a, you know, a friend of ours that was on here before, Ben Rosario with Hoka that way. Where does your income come in then? If I can ask that question, if I'm allowed to.
I get some of the money from the guys, but I have to make most of my money by coaching independently other people.
Okay.
I gave up my teaching career. Mm-hmm. You know, for this. So I have to, and I certainly don't make enough money from the 10 man elite guys who basically pay me out of the money they make from selling clothes.
So the brand,
they have very little money coming from Adidas.
Yeah.
They got shoes and stuff like that. Drew has a big contract. a couple of them have small contracts and the rest of them don't have any contract at all. Mm-hmm. You know, so that's why they, you know, they work hard to sell clothing and that sort of thing, is to fund their trips or their, you know, the Airbnbs and the flights to, you know, to wherever the competitions are. Mm-hmm. Most of the top athletes don't have this issue that are on other clubs or whatever. They don't. Mm-hmm. Right?
No, you're right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They don't, many of them don't have to work at all. Most of my guys have to work.
Mm-hmm. Are they most in running stores or anything like that? Or is it just
No, the variety. I mean, Jeff works for works at the front desk of the park and rec district. Last I recall, Joey was working for UPS, and I can't remember if he's still doing that or if it's something similar. I know Sydney works for, what's the name of that product company? They ship out all kinds of health nutrition products, a variety of them. Mm-hmm. They send out packs, but no, they don't work in running stores. None of them do. Mm-hmm.
It's amazing because by the way it looks, of course, on social media, so you can glamorize anything you want to, but it looks as if, hey, like this group's got all the sponsorship and that group has the sponsorship and stuff. But when it comes down to it, pro running, you're just still not making a lot of money because there's not a lot of opportunities. I think there's opportunities to perform, but they're starting to come up bit by bit. But at the same time, there's not that big media market for it. And so it's hard to get things like that going. I would agree. You know, would you agree on that?
It is, but you know, our sport does an awful job of bringing money in. Mm-hmm. An incredibly bad job. Oh, I said it for years. I've had all kinds of good ideas. You know, I've talked with all kinds of coaching friends about how we can make this better, but it amazes me. Look, when I'm old enough, I'll be 54 in a week. Mm-hmm. It amazes me what soccer has done. In the 70s and 80s, when I was growing up, mm-hmm. Soccer was all you played for 2 weeks out of the year in PE. There was no soccer in America otherwise.
And now it's huge.
And in the 1990s, mm-hmm. a few small individuals said, let's make soccer big. Mm-hmm. They organized, they did everything right. And within a few short years, they blew up. Now everybody wants to be a soccer player because there's money in it. Because it's an incredibly organized system. Mm-hmm. And everybody knows what the soccer players make for money. Nobody knows what the runners make in our sport. And that's a problem.
Yeah.
Because it holds down the amount that everybody can make. It not only holds down the money the ones who actually get it can make, mm-hmm. but it prevents other people from staying in the sport.
So why do you think that is?
Let me give you an example. Why do you think I've said this before on podcasts. Mm-hmm. A few years ago, maybe it's 5-6 years ago, I saw two different episodes on ESPN Classics. I like watching, you know, what the old basketball, football, baseball players all did back then. Yeah. And there's always really good stories on ESPN. So the first time I was watching it, I was half paying attention, working on something. And all of a sudden, I snapped my head around when I heard something. They had it, I think it was, I'm trying to remember who it was, Clyde
Drexler?
No. Can't think of his name. He's from Texas. He's a great basketball player. I think he played for UTEP. Anyway, Walt Frazier.
Okay.
They had Walt Frazier on there. And he was doing something like, oh, yeah, most of us had to work part-time jobs, you know, in the lumber yard or painting houses or whatever because we just didn't make enough money as professional athletes. I'm like, Walt Frazier, yeah. One of the best basketball players of his era, mm-hmm. was having to work part-time jobs, like in the off season, just to be able to put food on the table and pay his mortgage. That's crazy. And then the storyline went from these guys weren't making much money or very few. Then a small number got a little bit more than what everybody else was getting, but they were still required, just as they are in track and field now, to keep it quiet. Mm-hmm. But you know how football players are and basketball players. they tend to be a little bit on the confident side, if you know what I mean. Yes. And they just went, yeah, I'm untouchable. So they started blabbing, mm-hmm. get a little alcohol in them. They're at parties with their friends, and they blab about how much money they're making. Mm-hmm. And the other guys are like, you got to be kidding me. That's five times what I make.
And up it goes.
Okay, so then the word starts getting out. Mm-hmm. This is on ESPN Classics. Word starts getting out that a small number of guys are really making some good money compared to everybody else. And they knew the exact amount. Once it got into public arena, that amount, mm-hmm. it gave leverage to the guy coming out of college to say, I deserve more than that guy who's out there in the pros making XYZ amount. I broke all his records when I was in college. Mm-hmm. See what I'm saying?
Oh, we follow you, yeah.
Within 3 years of that information coming out, salaries for all of the pro basketball and all of the pro football players went up three times. Three times the amount. The average basketball player was making something like $17,900 in 1971, mm-hmm. which I'm just going to ballpark and say that's about 50 grand or something now. I don't know. Something yep. like that. Okay. Mm-hmm. That's all they were making. Within 3 years of that information getting out, the average salary was 151K for basketball players in the NBA. And the upper level guys were now making more than $1 million, where just 3 years earlier, but three guys were making about $250,000. Mm-hmm. Now there were like 35 making more than $1 million. This is what can happen in our sport. But everything is hush, hush. So here's the deal. Yep, not please. Only are the people who are already in the sport not getting money because the information is not known, but what we're doing is preventing younger athletes from going into our sport because they think it's an amateur sport. And for the most part, the way we manage it, it is. Mm-hmm. And so when they're talking to their parents about whether they should go out for cross country or whether they should go out for track or go out for soccer, it's a no-brainer to the parents. Hey, you can make a great You can make Messi $11 million a year, you know, coming out when you at your first year. Mm-hmm. The average, you know, pro soccer player makes $199,000 a year. We don't even think that there's any money in track and field. Mm-hmm. It's a no-brainer. So they put their kid, this kid who could be an extraordinary runner, they put him into soccer clubs starting young, and they build their knowledge and their skills and their fitness ability with the hope that someday they can be a pro soccer player. And there are thousands upon thousands, maybe a few million kids getting into the sport because there's money in it, or there's perceived there's money in it. So nobody wants to get into track and field unless they truly love it. They're not getting into it because they think there's money.
I know one thing as a college coach, there's definitely not money in this thing. It's definitely got to find some other things to be able to do, no matter if it's an easier system or not. So is one way to do that? I mean, I know you can go around blabbing and saying what your salaries are and that stuff, but is it something like the Pro Track series that's coming out with that stuff, that Trials of Miles that was just down there in Austin? Like, are those good starts, you think? And even the American Track League, are those good ways to actually get the sport at least a little bit more notoriety? Because that's something which we don't really have those series at all. We don't have anything like that around here. We had a couple meets here and there, but not much.
Well, yeah, of course, the more notoriety we get for the sport, the better. But I still say mm-hmm. you're going to run up against a barrier unless information gets out there about how much the upper level people are making. Mm-hmm. In my opinion, the vast majority, because I'm around agents and I'm around people and I hear stuff.
Yep.
Vast majority of money goes to females right now. Mm-hmm. Other than a few small individuals, your people like Galen Rupp or whatever, I'm sure is a millionaire, and he probably deserves it, you know, for what he's done. But, you know, until we get that info out into the public, we're just going to run up against barriers. And you're just going to – these guys who put on these meets like, you know, Dave Alfrano for Trials of Miles and that sort of – they're going to run up against a barrier. There's only so much money they can get. Mm-hmm. Because it's really perceived as an amateur sport.
No, that's very true. It definitely is. And I hope that kind of stuff works out well for a lot of the kids, because, man, we need the notoriety. We need to be able to see it. But to be able to get something on TV, on social media, just to be able to go will help us at least be able to have that conversation of let's get more money into the sport and how do we get more money into sport. It's good to actually see a couple of kids, a couple of people, you know, put their money into sport. Ben Blankenship putting that, you know, his prize money up for that mile down there.
Oh, Ben's awesome about that. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I say
so other things. Why is there...
Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Darren.
I was just going to ask, why is there a culture in track and field of, you know, I mean, I know it's kind of a long history of amateurism and things like that, but I mean, there's major sponsors now. And then with these marathons, I mean, they're dishing out tons of money, you know, for prize money and things like that. Why isn't it commonplace to talk about how much a track and field athlete is making both in salary and in sponsorship?
Well, think about it from the entity's point of view, from the Nikes and so on.
Sure, yeah.
If the info doesn't get out, then they don't have to pay more. So if they
do, you put think it, contractually put, they're bound to yeah.
Yeah, but also the agents push it. You know, in my view, the agents are missing the point, mm-hmm. right? If the agent is getting a standard cut of 15%. If the info gets out what certain individuals are making, and it raises, you know, the what's that expression, you know, a rising tide floats, you know, I don't know, floats all boats or whatever
raises
it is.
All ships.
Yes, yeah, something yeah. like that. Whatever it is, it makes sense. Look, if the info gets out there, then there becomes more money. Then the agents actually make more money. The agents are not doing themselves any good by, you know, making it in the contract that they have, there's a non-disclosure. I know that some of the entities do, but there's got to be some way around that.
Do you think a lot of that too is because we are considered an individual sport? And you know, you talk about team sports like basketball, football, and things like that.
Yeah, it's a huge problem. It's why I say all of these major track meets should have relays. The reason is everybody understands the concept of working together, a team effort to get that baton around. Listen, you can sit in the stands of Hayward Field in Eugene, and I used to go all the time because I lived there,
yep.
to the meets, okay? Grandma and grandpa, aunt and uncle are there to support granddaughter, grandson who happens to be running out there, okay? Mm-hmm. May not know the first thing about what a fast time is for that distance. They don't even know how far around the track 1500 meters is. Mm-hmm. Okay, but I guarantee you this, if you sat next to them when they start watching that relay, say it's a state track because like University of Oregon's Hayward Field hosted a state track meet for high school. Grandma and grandpa sitting in the stands, they get all excited when they see that 4x4 relay.
Yeah, you're right. Mm-hmm.
They don't know what a fast time is for the 4x4. They don't know that girls can break 4 minutes, you know, averaging under 60 seconds is a good performance at the high school level for that division, class 3 or whatever. They don't know that. Mm-hmm. But they know that those girls are working together, handing off that stick, that baton, and just whichever team gets to the end first, they're the winner. Whichever is second, they're second. Okay? They understand that. That's, and it's exciting.
We've kicked that idea around a lot. Even at the collegiate level, you know, having more dual meets and triangular meets to excite the common fan, the common person that mm-hmm. doesn't understand times and personal best. They understand winning and losing, right? Yes, they understand the score at the end of the meet, right? Yep. So, you know, and I think that's one component, you know, at the pro level that, you know, I mean, everyone gets excited for the Olympics because you see the medal total, right? And at the end of the day, we say, oh, well, you know, the United States walked away with more medals. So it's kind of like a rallying point, but we can't seem to get that together the years in between. You know, why is we only get excited during an Olympic year for track and field? Well, you know, I mean, I think that's, it's that, that team component.
We'll get back to that. I mean, if we added relays to all these major meets, whether it's the 4x8 or the distance medley or the 4x4 or the sprint, the more relays we add, the better, because they're all team events. And you know what? You see the extraordinary changes of position in races like the 4x4 or the 4x8. Mm-hmm. Some guy might be out in front or some gal might be out in front. And they got a 10-meter lead. The next hand up, you know, because there's strategy in deciding, do I put my fastest runner at the beginning of the four, team of four, the end? Where do I put them? You know, somebody might have two strong runners, their first and their fourth, but two mediocre or weak runners, second and third leg. Mm-hmm. So you see this big change in positions. They're out for 10 or 15 meters after the first lead, or in lead after the first one. But then the other team has put their a really good runner in team position two, or a better runner than the other team has a position. Next thing you know, they close the gap. It's so exciting.
Mm-hmm. So, right? So this brings me to an interesting thing. I wanted to ask about the mixed gender relay. What do you think about the mixed gender relay?
I think it's a good idea.
They basically said, well, yeah, you can run to whatever order you want.
I think it's a good idea. It makes it exciting. What we've needed in track and field is to get rid of pacing for a long time. I've said this 25, 30 years ago. I said this back in the early 90s, pacing will ruin the sport. Mm-hmm. Because it makes it so predictable and everybody's in a line and there's hardly any changes. It makes it boring.
Mm-hmm. You're not racing.
It's not dramatic.
Go to the U.S. Nationals or the Olympic Trials, and you don't have a pacer, and you don't know what's going on. You don't know what's going to happen, right? You don't know what somebody has planned. I'm watching the Olympic Trials the last time, and Bernard Lagat was in there along with some others in the 5,000-meter final, and some guy takes a flyer. He's like, hey.
Let's go.
I might get lucky. Mm-hmm. You never know. Maybe they won't come after me. The guy had like a 75, 80 meter lead at the mile mark, you know? Mm-hmm. It was exciting. And then everybody in the stand is like, are they going to go? When are they going to go? Are they going to wait too long?
Yep.
That was exciting. Mm-hmm. That's championship racing.
Yes.
You know?
We've said it before a lot of times on the show. We've said it before that you want to get that team race in there. You want to see what that happens. You forget putting a pacer on there and putting the LED lights in the bottom so you can watch that kind of stuff happen. Like if you're going to go for a distance, I think when they did it with the 24 hour relay, the hour, how far you can run in an hour, like they gave it some perception because nobody knows what the hell you're doing on TV with running an hour. So you have an idea where records are. But if you're going to bring something in where you can race, dude, let's let them go. I mean, you're right. When I've sit up at the, and I've been not a proponent, but I've been very critical of University of Wisconsin lacrosse when they host the WIA, excuse me, not lacrosse, but the WIA when they host the state meetup at lacrosse. And the fact that we don't know a thing going on, but it's a 4x8. And all of a sudden the girl I've seen, Verona, you know, pop up 855 or 854. And you're like, that was like the number three time in the country. Nobody knows it, but everybody's getting excited because guess what? Verona just won. Or some team has a race coming down for sixth, and the only thing they know is sixth place in Wisconsin is the last medal spot. And so they get excited for that kind of thing. Actually, just come to think about it, Tom, that'd be fun. If you did, if you took some of the big relay, big teams right now and put them up against each other in a mixed gender 4x8, you put, or just straight up. Dude, that would be a lot of fun. You could definitely broadcast that because now you have teams and you can get some sponsors, a Visa sponsor. Please, Visa, come help us out. But, you know, stuff like that to make this kind of stuff happen. That would be a blast.
Well, think about Visa and whoever. I mean, mm-hmm. Bank of America, mm-hmm. you know, ones who got some money. Amazon, Google, get them involved. Tesla, mm-hmm. you know, geez, yeah. get mm-hmm. any of the major players. Facebook, whatever. If it's team, they understand. In these major businesses, right, they mm-hmm. go to meetings, a weekly meeting or a monthly yep. meeting. They're talking about how the team needs to work together to achieve the mission statement or the goals. They're talking team, right? They know they can have a very successful business if they work together.
Correct.
But here we are in our sport. Everything is individual.
No, you got it. I mean, that's a very good point right there. I got to ask you, you had one thing you said was, I've had a lot of ideas on how to change the sport and improve track meets and stuff like that before. And it's something over the podcast that we've always asked that question of how do you change it? What's one of those ideas? You know, relays is one of them, but is there another idea to help change the sport, to help bring in viewership?
Yeah, well, a point series, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you get this Diamond League and that's kind of it, but unless you're, you know, Olympic caliber can medal in the Olympics, you don't score anything in these Diamond Leagues.
True, right? Very true.
Why not have more leagues where you're the American League, you know, where you're scoring points in the top 20, you know, make money, you know, from $100,000 down to $5,000 or whatever, you know, for the top 20. And you can get points, but not, you can get points from any event. So you might run a 5,000 meter at one event and a 1500 at another, or an 800. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. So just how you finish.
Points. You can accumulate points anyway in any event.
Yeah. So just be, you know, you could have it, as you said, you could have it, you could plan a season out. You could plan something out and at the same time be like, okay, this meet I can do a 5, I can go back in a 15, or I can do whatever the case might be. And then you get, excuse me, X amount of points for each one. And at the end of it, boom, you have a tally. I think that's a little bit like the Pro Track Series. We got to get Dave Melner on here and ask him about that stuff. I don't know what exactly their point system is going to be, but that could hopefully help out a little bit.
Well, and have a scaling system too. Mm-hmm. So if you would not be discouraged from running longer events because, oh, you're like, well, it's, you know, it takes me forever to recover. And if I don't score a point, then I got rebuild after that 10,000 meters for 4 weeks. Mm-hmm. Well, maybe you get 20 points. If you win the 10,000 meters, you get, I don't know, 12 points. I'm just throwing it out there. We could come up with a good scaling system. 12 points for a 5,000 and 8 points for a 1500 and 5 or 6 points for an 800. Cause you can run an 800 two or three times a week.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Seriously. Then you would have people, then you would see people doubling up.
You get true.
Even tripling, right? Mm-hmm. If you have a 2 day meet down in Texas or out in Portland or in New York City or Chicago, wherever, man, somebody's going to run the 800 to 1500 on one night, and they'll come back and do the event, different event on the next night just to score points.
Yeah.
Just like you would when you're on a high school or college team, you know, and you've got a 2 day event at the conference or nationals or whatever.
So, Tom, I have a question for you. You know, you've been in the game quite a while, and I'm curious to know how you've seen the sport change, maybe for the better, and then maybe, how you've seen the sport change negatively.
Well, social media,
in your mind.
Social media has made it hard for people to, because of social media, people don't want to compete. I'm telling you, people from my era and older competed all the time, and they were not necessarily fresh, hardly ever.
Yeah.
Right. We train through races. People train through races all the time. There wasn't the fact that you run in some meet that everybody in the world will know your performance like in the social media nowadays. Unless you got your name in the local newspaper or in track and field news, nobody knew. People raced all the time. There was more of it, and there was less money in the sport than there even is now. People raced for the competition factor. They raced. They weren't afraid to race. We got lots of people that are afraid to race now because they're not in top shape or they don't have fresh legs, and everybody's going to know that they didn't run super fast. I just think it's ridiculous that somebody has to be fast in, say, December of last year when the Olympic trials are in June. As an example,
well,
I did not sharpen Drew Hunter, you know, for that meet in San Capistrano in December, like I would for the Olympic trials. He was doing lots of repeat miles and 1Ks and temple runs and hills and disc long runs, good foundational training, which he should be doing that time of year. Right. And you got all these critics who are like, oh, it's not, it's gonna be my college kid. First of all, they're college kids in springy shoes. Second of all, they're not just average college kids. They got Northern Arizona's like a pro team, man. They're better than anybody but pretty much BYU and Nike's guys.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
I love my guys, but they would have a hard time, you know, head to head. Beat Northern Arizona, my guys would have to be on top of their game.
Mm-hmm.
Northern Arizona.
Don't you think that's the challenge now? As coaches, like that's the big challenge now is getting your athlete in the mindset where they can discard all that social media stuff. They can, you know, put that on the back burner and say, hey, we've got to get some experience here and we've got to work through some things. I mean, I think that's been a huge challenge.
Mm-hmm. I just think the whole social media thing has completely changed the sport. There's a small amount of it that's good, and there's more bad than good, in my view. Like I said, people are afraid to race unless they're absolutely great shape. They have fresh legs. They just don't want to look bad because they're going to get excoriated.
Mm-hmm.
And they worry about what everybody thinks in the social media because they follow it all the time.
That's true. Cause you actually have to have, you know, cause you have to look good no matter which one you're doing or what everything is, it has to be looked. It's a little bit glamorized. And I'm not sure the last time I saw maybe this weekend with Emma Coburn actually showing the fact that 5K didn't go well, was the only time, one of the rare times I've seen something where somebody posts a bad picture, not a bad picture, excuse me, but about a bad race. I think that's the better way to put it. Probably not a bad
picture. I think it's refreshing. It's refreshing when, you know, you see your professionals say, hey, like I struggle,
mm-hmm.
you know, I struggle through things. I think that's a smart social media move, you know, and you know, that you look at Emma Coburn, she's very marketable. She's, you know, probably one of the most marketable US athletes out there. And I think for her to do that is a important and big thing.
It speaks to her character. I mean, she basically sure. says, look, I didn't run well.
Yep.
But you know what? I'm going to bounce back. And there are a lot of people that didn't show up to compete down there in Austin.
Mm-hmm.
Because they were afraid of not being on their best game and not running a great race. And that hurts the sport.
It absolutely does.
Yeah.
We've seen that a lot more in the sprints world over the years where we have these big races and we're going to have two guys going at it. And then all of a sudden, oh, somebody has a sore hamstring or something like that. He tweaked something. And all of a sudden you're like, wow, that big race I was supposed to have. Yeah, that's gone. You know, you look at it and go, you know, Tom Brady took on my Green Bay Packers and Aaron Rodgers, you know, the NFC Championship game, but Tom Brady didn't, or Aaron Rodgers didn't sit back and go, you know what? I'm not going to play today. I'm just not feeling the greatest. Things exactly. aren't going well. Nobody said, screw this, let's go. And unfortunately, of course, my Packers lost. We won't talk about that one too much. That one hurt, you know?
Yeah, competitive toughness.
Yeah, your competitive toughness. Show up. Please, somebody show up and let's make this compete. Kind of stuff happen. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we'd love to see that.
Any of us who played other sports,
mm-hmm.
I think a lot of people in the sport of track and field, or, you know, in distance running in general, need to toughen up.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I can't tell you how many times athletes, not just me, but athletes on my team played through knee pain or ankle pain or lower back pain. We just toughed it out, got out there and played with our team and tried to help our team win.
I think that's one thing I love about Des Linden. She is so tough. I think she's a great example. Absolutely. For anybody in our sport.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, see what she did at Boston and just see the way she is, the way she trains, and she's tough.
My wife will watch that Boston thing, and she's not, you know, the big of a runner. She's been in the running, so she's the hobby jogger, but she watched Des Linden run and she's like, that was just something powerful. That was exciting the way she competes.
Well, you also, part of it is you just didn't know what was going to happen.
Oh, that was a brilliant day.
And it's just like the championship race. There's no pacers. You don't know what's going to happen. Anything can happen. And that race, that Boston race, the adversity they had to face with the rain pelting them at an angle. They were drenched. And, you know, I'm sure they went through waves and waves of doubt in their mind, whether it is worth it to keep doing this. And to the credit of Des Linden, she didn't give up, even though she could have. Mm-hmm. There were some other people in the race that did really well that toughed it out. But I got to tell you, anybody who watched that race admired them for pushing through. Mm-hmm. It wasn't, we all knew, those of us who know the sport well, knew that they were not going to run a fast time.
No, from right? The gun. Yep, from the gun, you knew that.
But that's not what you remember. That's not what you remember. You remember the guts of the performance. Oh. That's what I love about it.
I think back to a long time ago to some of the great races that I used to watch on TV, like NBC or whatever, would cover them. You know, I remember watching Toshihiko Seiko and Bill Rogers duke it out. Oh, wow. And Craig Virgin was up there in Boston, you know. Mm-hmm. I remember Alberto Salazar and Dick Beardsley duking it out. I remember, I mean, they did maybe one or two second difference between them at the end. Like, what was it, 208, 58 or something was the winner, something like that. There was, if it wasn't for the fact that Dick Beardsley stepped in a pothole, I mean, this could have been leaning at the tape type of thing. And I remember Rod Dixon, the best race I ever saw, the most exciting one I ever saw, was the New York City Marathon. I think it was 1983, if I recall correctly. And Rod Dixon came from way back. Jeff Smith of England flew that first half. I mean, he was way, way out in front. And he started running gradually out of steam over the last 5 miles, ever so slightly. He was slowing down. And Rod Dixon, the question was he going to catch him? Because now at 3 miles to go, he's about maybe 500 yards behind, you know, at 2 miles, at 1 mile, and he catches him right at the 26-mile mark.
Man.
And beats the poor guy. I felt bad for Jeff Smith because the guy laid it out there. But at the same time, I love that the suspense, right? That was real racing, you know? I remember certain events like that, like they were just last month. I remember watching Rob DiCostella and Carlos Lopez, you know, in the Rotterdam Marathon. That was on TV. You probably find all these ones that I'm mentioning on YouTube.
Yeah, I bet YouTube has them.
Mm-hmm. And basically, you know, Rob DiCostella caught Lopez right at the end. And it was amazing. You know, there was more competitive stuff that was happening as opposed to just fast pacers, and all we ever see is what's going on in the front, right? When we're watching.
Yeah, you never see the drama that's unfolding in the middle. Yeah.
I don't understand that with today's technology. Why can't we have two, if not three or four different, you know, portions on the screen where we can see the front pack or this front guy, the main pack, those in the middle who are trying to move up. You know, why can't we see all those?
That'd be great. I mean, you watch NASCAR and everything, you've got the whole commercial on the right side, you got the race going on the left. And there's been a couple times in some of the last major marathons where, you know, I'm trying to think a name out, but then all of a sudden so-and-so's gone. Or yeah, let's just say Sarah Hall is all of a sudden she's in the pack, and then all of a sudden she's out, and you don't see your name up there, and you're like, where did she go? And
exactly,
I'm not picking on Sarah, but it's happened once or twice where a name like that goes, and you're like, oh yeah, Sarah Hall dropped out. And you're like, wait, you're just going to kind of kick the can on that one? Like, you couldn't have told us what happened when that happened? I would love to be able to see full marathons and a couple different camera views on what's going on. You've got enough motorcycles.
Well, we could have watched and saw that Sarah Hall or whoever it happens to be was struggling. She had a side ache or she was tightening up her shoulders. And we're like, oh, she's starting to fade in that pack. Mm-hmm. Wonder what's going to happen. Is she going to bounce back or is she going to drop out? Or she just, you know, going to fade away from that pack gradually, but she's not going to give up. Yeah. You know, all those things are, what it comes down to is personification. We put ourselves in the position of that athlete. We've all faced those extraordinarily difficult moments. The moments when we wondered if we could survive, the moments that we wondered if we could hold on. And then there's also some redemption. There are moments when we overcame, we redeemed ourselves. We can redeem ourselves within the race, or we can redeem ourselves from a previous race.
Mm-hmm. I think that's why, you know, when you mentioned that, you know, time trialing and doing this stuff, it hurts our sport because we just lose that competitive factor. But I feel like, you know, that's a lot of the culture, especially in distance running, that is being created right now is, oh, you have to run this time if you're going to qualify for this. Right.
Let me throw this out there. We talked earlier about a scoring system, right? Having a circuit. Yep. Mm-hmm. What if you could get into the Olympic trials or to the U.S. Nationals without hitting a time, but you scored well, scored enough points in all these races?
Okay. Never thought of this one before.
Yeah, I think it's a great idea. I think a competitive incentive.
Don't you think a competitive incentive.
Then you're going to get the best competitors there, you would assume.
Then people would compete more because it's not necessarily about how fast you run.
Now, could you combine
the two? Right, about how you compete.
So what if you combine the two? Let's say, okay, you've got a standard. Let's just throw a number out there and say 3150 for a women's 10K. Let's just throw, okay, there's your standard. You got to hit that to get in so people can hit that. Or maybe it's a lot faster. You know, I'm just, again, throwing a number out there. And then you're like, okay, but in the system that we're running, we hit, like, if you hit X amount of points, you can also get in. So you get both of those. Yep. And so maybe somebody has an injury and all of a sudden the last second, they're like, man, I got to qualify. And it's one of the nation's best 10K runners, and boom, they can hit that standard. So they at least get to the meet. Cause if not,
some people are just great competitors too. Some people are just great competitors, and they might not be able to time trial, you know, like a certain person, but like they can compete when it's on the line. So I think that's gotta be a factor.
Your point is perfect because nationals or Olympic trials is not about time. Most of the time you're competing one.
It's crazy.
One against the other. So why can't we encourage that? Let's get the best competitors.
It's crazy. I agree.
Man, I love it. I love it. We just actually right there. We just changed the whole U.S. track and field system there with three guys in a podcast going, this is what we need to do.
And then you shouldn't have to compete only in the event just to be able to qualify for the event. Good example is how USA Track and Field did it for the marathon. If you hit a half marathon equivalent or even slightly harder, right?
Yep.
You didn't have to hit the marathon time to go to the Olympic Trials Marathon.
Yes.
Why can't we do that for like the 10K, 10,000 on the track? Let's say you're a woman and I don't know, what is it, 3230. I don't remember what it is. Mm-hmm. Let's say it's 3230 and it's the equivalent is 1525. Well, if let's say you run 1522.
It's, yeah, you're under that. Your equivalency would say you're going
to
run
Maybe they put some other stipulations in there. You've got to run it. You've got to run whatever. You can do a combination of points. Mm-hmm. Or times at various distances to get in. You can move up one event or down one event if you're going to go by time.
That could be brilliant right there.
I don't know. I'm just ballparking in, you know, maybe we come up with a form. But if you got a bunch of educated people, get a bunch of coaches out there. I don't care if they're D1 coaches or whatever it is. Just get a bunch of experienced coaches out there and have them sit together and on a Zoom meeting and throw out ideas and start creating this system.
We could. That's what we do a lot of weeks. As we first started doing this kind of stuff, we can make this happen. Coach, one more question here, and then we'll let you roll because I want you to eat dinner. It's probably a little bit cold, and I apologize for that one. Hopefully it's good. Next time I see you, hopefully I'll warm you up some dinner and make you something good. But what's the – you've been around a lot. You've seen a lot. You dropped a lot of big names and that stuff. What's that favorite race you've ever seen? There's got to be one that, like, boom, that one. Because you ripped off a lot of names from Rogers and Salazar and everybody in between. Or is there something that, like, there was another race or something you've seen? What would be that, let's say – there's probably a bunch of them, but is there one that sticks out?
Yeah, I can think of a lot of good ones. You know, I think of the 800-meter race from Moscow Olympics 1980, and Steve Ovette won it. there's a big showdown coming between Ko and Ovette, and basically Ko got to the front just like Matt Centrowitz did in Rio, and Ko and Ovette got to the front because it was a slow pace, and you know he ran about a 50 flat on his second lap because they ran slow on the first lap, and Ko had positioned himself too far back, and basically Ko would have had to run like a 48 high on the second lap to win. Just like Matt Centrowitz ran the slowest time since 1936 in the Olympics to win. Right?
Yep.
But he got himself to the front. But this the Ovette-Ko matchup, that was a great one. There was so much hype, so much mystery, and Ko and Ovette wouldn't race against each other because neither one wanted to go, you know, lose their rep. And they were also probably making money on the side, you know. But that was a big deal. Paul Turgot and Haile Gebrselassie, that was a good one. I think it was in Atlanta, 10,000 meters. It came down to basically a stride or so. Hikmael Guerrouche, Bernard Lagat are, you know, in the Olympics, and I think it was Atlanta as well. Trying to remember, there was one with Morsely. Trying to remember, it was pretty good. I can,
you
think
know, the
of
one thing that you mentioned
them,
here
really.
with all these great historic races, and we talked to Christian Taylor about this last week, and there seems to be a narrative along with these races, right? It's almost like two heavyweights that are sparring and training, getting ready to face off each other. And I think we need to do a better job in track and field of telling the story, telling the narrative. And because I think that creates excitement, and it creates a connection, you know, what these racers are about.
Well, that's absolutely true. You know, when I was thinking of those marathons, a lot of those had something in common is that they do personal interviews long before the athlete shows up. So you get to see what Desi Linden, how she trained, you know, out there in the countryside of Michigan when she was living there, or Joan Benoit Samuelson back in the day when she was running in, you know, the country roads near Portland, Maine, where she grew up, you know, or Craig Virgin in Southern Illinois and the gravel roads near his small little town of Lebanon where he grew up in the farm.
Yep.
You know, I mean, those are kind of cool things. Also, what, you know, we talk about redemption. I like the story. I like the stories where we get an insight that the person struggled through, you know, and finally is back. You know, a good example of that is that young man. I can't think of his name. I wish I could. He ran 60 meters the week before last, and he's really, really highly talented, highly extraordinary.
Trayvon Bromell?
Huh?
Trayvon Bromell.
Bromell,
yeah. That's
a
comeback
story,
right
man.
Yep.
What a great story. Yeah. That guy overcame. He could have quit the sport.
Yeah.
Right. But he didn't give up, and his coach believed in him, and he fought through, and now he's back on top of his game. And to be honest, if he carries this momentum,
he's going to be good.
Olympics,
it's dangerous.
I can see him meddling.
Yeah.
No doubt.
And just 2 years ago, he thought about quitting because he was so jacked up with injuries. You know, that's an extraordinary story.
I love those
amazing.
Things. Love those things.
I like these stories of these people that came from small college. Like a Noah Draddy, who lives right over here next to us, okay? He was not a big D1 runner. But he made himself into a star runner in marathoning here in America, even though he was a small time runner in college. Pete Fitzinger was that. Pete Fitzinger went to a little bitty Bucknell University. He was like 112th and 123rd or something, two different years in the national cross country meet for D1. Little bitty college, didn't do anything extraordinary in college, but the guy didn't give up. That was a great story, man. He pushed himself, said, I'm going to be successful. I'm not walking away from this sport. I'm going to find my niche. I'm going to do something extraordinary. I'm just going to get out there and train, train, train. I'm going to show people. And he did. He won our Olympic trials and upset some great athletes like Salazar and Shorter and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Right? He did well in the Olympics. I mean, I think he was 11th or something like that. That was an extraordinary story.
The stories are what inspire us. You know, they're what connects us to life and everyday struggles. So I think if we can do a better job of telling these stories, just like Trayvon Brummell, I mean, those stories need to be told. Mm-hmm. A story, you know, the Chris Taylor's story needs to be all these people that are doing extraordinary things. This just didn't happen overnight. They've all gone through struggles. They all have a story. And I think it's really important that we tell it.
Well, you know what I can tell you working with elite runners is, they tend to think, the ones that I'm working with tend to think when they have an injury that, you know, nobody else out there is getting injured and nobody else is struggling. Part of it is that, you know, the other athletes and the other clubs or teams are keeping it quiet.
Mm-hmm.
But I happen to know that this happens all the time. People get injured. Matt Centrowitz is a great example. He's been injured about a dozen times in the last 3-4 years. He never gives up, and I admire him greatly for that.
Yep.
But he gets injured quite often.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, injury goes with the territory. These guys are not Jane and Joe joggers jogging 2 or 3 miles a day. You know, they're pushing themselves.
Yeah, you have to push the limit to be as good as they're going to be.
That's right. That's right. And it's always a fine line between getting what you need to get to the next level and too much where it breaks you down. It's very difficult. And humans are not robots. They vary from day to day. Biological variation is so profound. You know, literally, if you think about this, if you could race a 1330 and you're an elite guy on Saturday, what's the chances you can run 1330 3 days later on Tuesday or the following week on Thursday or Friday when you're doing that workout?
Mm-hmm. That's a tough one.
Probably 1 in 5.
Yeah. If you're lucky.
Maybe. Mm-hmm. 10%, 1 in 10.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but that's what's exciting about the story, sport. But, you know, I think we've covered a lot. I hope that's enough to.
No, that works. That works out well. No, absolutely. No,
it's incredible. It's incredible. Yeah. And it goes along with the theme that we've been talking about for weeks and weeks is just, you know, to be a master of your craft, it takes resilience, no matter what it is. And there's going to be struggles and there's going to be more struggles than there are successes. Well, but you just keep fighting, you know, you keep fighting.
You know, if you're interested in learning about what goes behind success, And overcoming the myth that the people who are extraordinary are just so talented, you got to read books about this topic. And I would suggest you start with Anders Ericsson, who basically did all the doctoral research and then postdoctoral research on success. He's the one that, like Malcolm Gladwell, talking about 10,000 hours. That's taken from Ericsson.
Yes.
Right.
He references
it's
that.
It's actually not 10,000. That's a distortion. It's, but anyway, you need to read the books by Erickson. Let me see if I can find the book and recommend it to others. Also, another great book is Angela Duckworth's book called Grit. That's a really good one.
List to read it. I gotta get that one.
Yeah, yeah. If you read the book, how so much of success that we thought was attributed to natural talent was not.
Mm-hmm.
That the individual, whatever domain it is, whether it's in sports, business, music, whatever, they very often struggled, and they had better methods, or they came upon a better method through trial and error to get them to a new level. You know, this goes back to what we talked about at the very beginning, where individualizing your training based on your unique profile is really a big deal.
But the struggle is finding that profile, right? Like that's where there's a lot of that trial and error and failure is finding what profile you are, so you can, you know, figure out which path to take.
Well, that's true.
I think that's what people need to realize is like part of that process and part of that struggle is going to get you to that point where you can break through.
Yeah. And you know, so many people stop too early. You know, success is very often just around the corner. I thank you for inviting me. Sorry if I started out a little bit intense and fresh. I've been working for hour upon hour on my dissertation, and I think I was pretty stressed out when I started. So
no, it's okay. We need to get you relaxed a little bit. Yeah, I appreciate
it. It's been a pleasure.
The knowledge. Absolutely, sir.
All right, fellas. You guys take care of yourself. Okay.
You as well, Tom. Thank you. Appreciate it,
buddy. All right. Thanks, Tom.
Oh man, I tell you what, that was a lot of fun. That was unbelievably fast paced. Again, we can't thank Coach Schwartz enough for sitting down with his dinner. I know he was eating it in between bites and getting a little bit cold. Wonderful wife brought it over for him. So I truly appreciate him again spending time with us and doing that. I was blown away by the fact that Tin Man Elite uses all those Tin Man shirts and sales to help fund where they go, their travel, their bed and breakfasts, everything that they do, to learn that most of those guys are not on that pro contract. Most of those guys are still trying to make it. It's definitely a grassroots type of thing, even in Adidas Rogue that started down there in Austin, Texas. So that was incredible to hear. It was great to hear the passion, though, that he has for the sport and how he does want to make his athletes better and how much fun that he loves to have this. You can just see it. I know you guys don't get to see his face, but man, you can just see the smile on his face when he started talking about his athletes in the world of track and field. So that one was a ton of fun. As always, ladies and gentlemen, we thank you for joining us here on the Off Track Podcast, and thank you for making us one of the best running podcasts in the country. If you word of mouth is without question the best form of advertisement, share this podcast with your friends, share it with anybody you think might find value in this, whether it be in Spotify or iTunes. If it's on Spotify, give us 5 stars. If it's iTunes, give us 5 stars. Give us a rating. Let us know what we can do better. Feel free to hit any of us up with anybody you'd love to hear us talk to on the podcast or any connections you may have had. And hey, if anybody needs a sponsor, we'd love to have you join us. So we do this for free on the side, so we'd love to have you join us. So ladies and gentlemen, we'll try and do better again next week. We've got an exciting next 3 weeks set up for you already. So have a great week, and we look forward to talking to you again.